Welcome everyone to this week's quantum gravity seminar. Our speaker today is Atul Sharma from Oxford, talking about twister action for GR. During the talk, our speaker is fine with questions, so if you have a question, please raise your virtual hand. Without further ado, Atul, the stage is yours.
Thanks, Benjamin. And thanks all of you for giving me the opportunity to speak here. I'm going to talk about some work on the formal side of gravity that actually arose from a collaboration that's going on with David Skinner and your own Roland Biddleston. This is based on my paper from April. And also, if time permits, I'm going to mention some work on scattering amplitudes, graviton scattering amplitudes that I've been doing with my PhD supervisor, Lionel Mason, and Tim Adamo, who's now a faculty at Edinburgh. So I work in the field of scattering amplitudes, where you see miracles sort of happening a lot. And the most famous sort of miracle that everyone should know or should hear at least once in their lifetimes about is the Park-Taylor formula for gluon scattering amplitudes. And this is where the motivation for our story begins. So when you compute the gluon scattering amplitude at tree level, you quickly observe that the billions and billions of Feynman diagrams that you need to sum to get the amplitude collapse down to a single term expression very quickly. So here I've just displayed the expression. You don't need to understand it too deeply. The angle brackets here are some Lorentz covariant contractions built out of the components of the momenta of those gluons. But the miracle or the beauty of the formula is that independent of however many gluons interact in the scattering process, if you compute the scattering amplitude of two negative helicity gluons and n minus two positive helicity gluons, then it always collapses to a single term expression. This fact was noticed by Park and Taylor in 86, and there are many recursive proofs that people have come up with, like BCFW recursion relations or other recursion relations that you may have heard of. Laura?
Just a question, is that a tree level result or it's a whole loop result?
It's a tree level result, yes. Just the tree level for scattering of two negative velocity with that minus two positive velocity.
And we expect something like that at all loops too, or it's not known?
We do expect results that are simpler than what you would get from Feynman diagrams. And most of the simplicity at loop level that people have worked out is in the case of n equals four super Young mills, because stuff is easier to do there. But I think there are some ways to that people have been building to bootstrap the amplitudes using some very basic building blocks that look like these rational functions. So we do expect some sort of simplicity to emerge out of that. But I think people still have to work it out more deeply in QCD. But there are many results in n equals four super Young mills. Okay, so there's a similar phenomenon that happens in gravity, where if you compute the tree level graviton scattering amplitude, you observe that the scattering amplitude is still given by a single term expression. This time, the amplitude is a determinant. So it's a single term expression in the sense that it's a single compact determinant, which is much more surprising, which is even more surprising than the gluon case, because if you compute the scattering of gravitons in just perturbatively expanded Einstein-Hilbert action, then you see that at each, as the number of gravitons scattering in the process increases, the number of interaction vertices that you have to include in your Feynman diagrams also grows exponentially, which is not the case in gauge theory, where you only have three and four particle interaction vertices. But even so, gravity still has this simple structure. All those diagrams for arbitrary number of gravitons interacting combine to give this simple single determinant where you have these entries, which again, you don't need to remember for the rest of the talk. But I just want to show you that there's great simplicity, at least in the tree level scattering of pure gauge theory and pure gravity, and also if you go to supersymmetric theories than at loop level. Now, any such simplicity, which is not obvious from the viewpoint of Feynman diagrams or the standard way of doing quantum field theory, always points to an alternative way of doing stuff. So usually these alternative ways hint at some hidden dual theory that might be actually behind producing these answers in a much simpler and much more manifestly simple way. So can you find a dual theory that just gives you these answers without actually having to do all the Feynman diagram nonsense? Where is the simplicity hiding in gravity? Now, in the gauge theory case, the simplicity was explained by means of Pfister strings and Pfister actions. So this was a program that was started by Park and Taylor and then Nair and then Zwiebern and Lance Dixon and other people. But it really came into its own by the work of Edward Witten in 2003, who actually studied a topological string theory in Pfister space, which he called Pfister string. The beauty of this string theory was that it allowed you to compute all tree-level gluon amplitudes, whether they be involving as many negative helicity particles as you like. So on the previous page, I showed you an amplitude of 2 negative helicity and n minus 2 positive helicity scattering. With Pfister strings, you can compute beautiful world sheet formulae, which are at least formally very beautiful, and they can also be concretely used to generate answers for an arbitrary number of particles and arbitrary number of negative and positive helicity distributions. And then concrete formulae were written down by these other people, Roy Bounds, Pradlin, Wolowitz from Brown. The Pfister action business started, well, Witten started it basically because when he studied the target space effective action of Pfister strings and showed that that action can be written as a holomorphic Chern-Simons theory. So Pfister strings actually compute the scattering amplitudes of not just gauge theory, but n equals 4 supersymmetric gauge theory. It just so happens that at tree level, you can easily extract the pure gluon components of those amplitudes. But it gives you much more. It gives you the amplitudes of n equals 4 supersymmetric gauge theory. And if you compute the effective action of these Pfister strings on Pfister space, I'll tell you what Pfister space is later. Pfister space is some auxiliary space that is related to space-time in a non-local way, which is roughly complex projective three space. If you compute the effective action of these Pfister strings, it takes the form of a holomorphic Chern-Simons theory, plus some non-local interaction terms that somehow generate local dynamics in space-time. And these Pfister actions, the problem with Pfister strings was that you couldn't actually go ahead and prove that the dynamics of Pfister strings will necessarily give you the dynamics of space-time perturbation theory from Feynman diagrams. It was just an observation that Witten made that gave a formula that computes scattering amplitudes. Pfister actions, on the other hand, are the effective actions of Pfister strings, and you can actually use the Penrose transform to prove that they are equivalent to the space-time actions for gauge theory. And this was done by these people in the non-supersymmetric case by Lionel, my supervisor, and in the supersymmetric case by Skinner, Lionel, Rutger Bowles, Matt Bellimo, Tim Adamo, and they also study the conformal gravity case. And there has been some renewed interest by Kevin and Roland, which is good to see. And it was this Pfister action that finally explained the constructive origins, the first principles origins of Park-Taylor formula, because now you have a theory which you can manifestly prove to be equivalent to the space-time action off shell. And then you can use the perturbation theory of that dual theory on Pfister space to compute the perturbation theory of that space-time theory and prove the Park-Taylor formula constructively. And the Pfister action just gives you the Park-Taylor formula. It's just so magical that you don't have to sum any Feynman diagrams. Every MHV amplitude has just one Feynman diagram in the Pfister action. So that was just a quick sort of background. So I'll give you so here's a summary of the rest of the talk, depending on how much time I find. I'll try to give some more motivations and I'll try to mention some connections to other fields. Then I'll talk about the nonlinear graviton construction by Roger Penrose, which will form the backbone of my my paper and my talk. And then I'll talk about the twister action for gravity. And time permitting, this I probably won't reach here, but I can, if time permits, then I can talk about some applications of the twister action to computing the Hodges, the graviton MHV amplitude formula that I showed you on the first slide, that determinant D formula. Okay, so I'll go for two more slides and then I can ask for questions. So up to the motivations. The idea of a twister action, let me just summarize the idea of a twister action so that you can at least take away the rough intuition here. The idea is as follows. We work in Euclidean signature. We can work in Lorentzian signature as well, but it's much easier and much clearer to work in Euclidean signature. So I'm going to stay there in this talk. For Euclidean signature, twister space is nothing complicated. As a smooth manifold, it's just R4 times the Riemann sphere. So basically just R4 times CP1, where CP1 is the Riemann sphere. But it's given, it's it's imbued with a non-trivial complex structure, which sort of breathes life into it. The complex structure is that of two copies of the rank 1 O1 bundle of a P1. Again, I'll give you a picture on the coming slides. The point is that you can build an action on R4 times P1. So I have displayed the action roughly in a schematic form for the Yang-Mills case. The action has two fields. It has a field A, which will correspond to positive velocity gluons on spacetime, and a field B, which corresponds to negative velocity gluons on spacetime. It has a kinetic term, B d bar A, where d bar is the anti-holomorphic exterior derivative in the complex structure associated to this complex manifold. And it has a bunch of non-local interaction terms that compute MHV amplitudes for you. And the magic here is that if you take this theory and you compactify this on P1, then you can compactify it exactly. And you don't get any KK modes. The reduction produces for you the Yang-Mills action on spacetime, plus a topological deformation term. It just so happens that for perturbation theory purposes, the topological term can be neglected. It doesn't affect scattering amplitudes because it's a boundary term. So this action generates the same scattering amplitudes from its perturbation theory that the Yang-Mills action would generate on space-time from its perturbation theory. And this is the magic that gives you the Park-Taylor formula. So what happens is here on space-time, in the space-time theory, to generate the Park-Taylor formula, you'd have some billions and billions of Feynman diagrams built out of 3 and 4 particle gluon vertices. But on twister space, you get one interaction vertex for each MHV amplitude. If you look here carefully, B squared are 2 negative velocity gluons, and A to the n-2 are n-2 positive velocity gluons. So each of them for a particular given n contributes a single Feynman diagram for each MHV amplitude. And that's the real origin of the simplicity of the Park-Taylor formula, a theory in 6 dimensions, some sort of a mother theory that generates a Park-Taylor amplitude for you in one go. But it gives you even more. It gives you what are called MHV rules. These MHV rules are actually the Feynman rules of this twister action. If you take these interaction vertices off-shell, then they give you some sort of off-shell extension of the MHV amplitude of the Park-Taylor formula, which you can glue together using the D-bar, using the propagator associated to this D-bar operator. And when you glue these together, you can build more complicated amplitudes. You find formally for next to MHV amplitudes, so amplitudes involving 3 negative velocity gluons, 4 negative velocity gluons, and so on, built out of not Feynman diagrams, but these so-called MHV diagrams whose vertices are MHV amplitudes and propagators are D-bar inverses. So this is the MHV rules of the Cacciazzo-Schwarzschild-Witten recursion relation that was found in 2004 and proven using the twister action in a posteriorly proven by Bowles, Mason, and Skinner. And this allows very compact and very efficient evaluation of scattering amplitudes. This is actually a precursor of BCFW recursion. Any questions about this slide? This is sort of the big overview.
Bianca has a question. Bianca. Go ahead.
Can you explain more this compactify procedure?
The compact, I am going to explain it a bit more in the gravitational case on the slides.
Okay. So is it
otherwise?
Is it mixing these two R4 and S2 into something new? It's not just.
So no, the beauty is that this action looks like it's mixing the R4 and S. So these fields B and A are functions of coordinates on R4 and S2. It looks like this action is dependent in a wild way on the locations in R4 and S2. But this action is secretly not. It has some extended gauge symmetry, which actually gauges away translations along rotations along this S2. And so somehow it trivializes the dependence of these fields along this S2. And I'm going to talk about this gauge symmetry in the gravitational case. And this is why you get a theory that secretly only lives on the R4 fibers.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the question. That was a good question. Okay, I'll move on. And there are also some broader connections that have been showing up in particular by work in work on integrable systems by Costello. So there was a talk by Costello, and there was a paper by Roland and David Skinner, where they showed that they can also build this kind of Chern-Simon-Seatwister actions. So, I should say that theories like this, actions on this twister space, are what I'm going to call twister actions. And if you build Chern-Simons type twister actions, in contrast to the BD bar A style BF theories, then you can get different varieties of actions for self-dual Liang-Mills on space-time. This is a classical theorem by Richard Ward. On shell, Richard Ward proved in the 80s that if you study self-dual Liang-Mills, solutions of the self-dual Liang-Mills equations correspond to holomorphic vector bundles on twister space. And this can be extended off-shell to say that solutions of general Liang-Mills, off-shell gauge fields, not even solutions of Liang-Mills equation, off-shell gauge fields correspond to some almost complex almost holomorphic vector bundles on twister space. And in terms of those off-shell fields, you can build an action whose equations of motion impose the integrability condition on shell. And this is an action for self-dual Liang-Mills. You can compactify this on space-time and get different actions for self-dual Liang-Mills. Yeah.
There's a question, my Laurent.
I have a question about the difference between this Chern-Simons formulation and the BF1. I thought the BF1, you also get self-dual Liang-Mills.
You do. In this case, you get different.
Okay.
You get different actions for self-dual Liang-Mills. So the BF action just imposes self-duality as a Lagrange multiplier constraint. Mm-hmm. But these actions sort of these actions contain only positive elliptic gluons in some sense. So the BF theory is sort of a first order formalism, and these actions give rise to second order formalisms. Their equations of motion still give you solutions to the self-dual Liang-Mills equations in a particular gauge, actually.
But they are different at the quantum level, you mean? Or
they are different at the quantum level, yes.
Okay. But this action only contains A, right? There's no negative.
That's the beauty of this action, that it's a second order formulation, yeah. And Kevin has also recently talked about applying twisted holography to relate the BF type twister actions on the previous slide to celestial holography to get soft theorems and celestial operator product expansions. So that's just something for people who know celestial holography, but if you don't, then you can forget about that. It's a very pretty subject that I've been working on as well. I think this is all, there are more talks after this, which you could try to look at. Okay. So now let's sort of start in earnest. And after this, you can just ask me questions whenever you like. This might not be a very standard field for many of you. So as I said previously, I'm going to work in Euclidean signature. This is somewhat annoying. One would like to work in Lorentzian signature to get the full structure of general relativity manifest. But at the moment, the most rigorous way of constructing these actions that we have is in Euclidean signature. There are analogs in Lorentzian signature, but the problem is that twister space for real Lorentzian spacetime is not a complex manifold. It's a 5 real dimensional manifold. So we don't fully understand the Lorentzian signature case. In Euclidean signature, twister space is a 6 real dimensional manifold on which you can put almost complex structures. Yeah, Laura.
Just a question about that. How do you access radiation then? Because, for a massless theory, if you're on shell, there's no Euclidean version of radiation. But in twister space, there must be. But P square equals zero means there's nothing left. That's what I mean. So Euclidean action for massless objects are very, very, they're missing.
So. Yeah, I completely agree. So we don't fully understand how one would access, say, Lorentzian scattering amplitude, for example. That's the sort of case that I understand. But the point is, at tree level, at least, these theories produce the scattering amplitude can be read off as the on-shell action. So there are ways to take that on-shell action, compute some scattering amplitude in Euclidean signature, and then analytically continue to Lorentzian signature. And similarly, you can take by radiation, I'm assuming you mean some sort of classical solutions which have some radiated profile.
Is the quantum operator that corresponds to the new, if you want, like anything that is this, that excites fields which were on shell at P square equals zero, which in the Euclidean, there would be no field, right? So any on shell massless object is.
Yeah, so any of these null. Yeah.
Yeah, the null questions nullness in Euclidean is nothing, right?
Yeah.
This is what I was
being sad about, that we still don't have a rigorous way to build these twister actions in Lorentzian signature.
Okay.
So the best we can do is take Euclidean signature quantities and sort of analytically continue them. And that works for amplitudes, so that makes us very happy in the gauge theory case. And the hope is that similar calculations for amplitudes will work in gravity as well. So I realize that's not a very satisfying answer, but hopefully there'll be a better answer in the future. Okay, so twister space for four-dimensional real Euclidean space-time is R4 times P1, which is diffeomorphic to a copy of CP3 with a single copy of CP1 removed. So this is how twister space is usually presented in the literature. It's a copy of complex projective 3 space, which is basically C4 with a quotient by overall scalings. So you can take homogeneous coordinates on CP3, which are usually represented as capital Z. And in the scattering amplitudes literature, twisters, the two component spinners that build up the twister are usually denoted by mu upper alpha dot and lambda alpha, where alpha dot and alpha are two component spinner indices of opposite helicity. If you've read any twister literature, you could think of mu as omega and lambda as pi in the old notation. In any case, these are two component spinners and the twister is a four component object. And the copy of P1 that you remove from this P3, so these are homogeneous coordinates. To get P3, you basically just quotient out by overall rescalings of mu and lambda. So an overall T times Z. The copy of P1 that you remove is this copy when you say the copy where you that you obtain by setting both the lambda alpha coordinates to zero, where you'd only have two mu alpha dot coordinates. And what this does for you is it turns the lambda alphas into coordinates on a CP1 in their own right, because lambda alpha, because the homogeneous coordinates on a complex projective space cannot be zero simultaneously. So removing the locus where lambda alpha is zero turns lambda alpha into a CP coordinates on a CP1 in their own right. And then you get this sort of a picture of twisted space. So this is the bundle picture that I was mentioning earlier. Twisted space can be intuitively thought of as a copy of CP1, which I have drawn here as a complex projective line, straight line, and lambda alpha homogeneous coordinates along it. And twisted space is a fiber bundle over this with fibers that are each copies of the space-time R4. It's just that these copies are rotated in the sense of complex structure. So you view the complex structure on this as slightly different from being the complex coordinates on this as being slightly different from the complex coordinates on this. So you can just think of twisted space as this sort of revolving series of sheets. And then there is some classical structure here on twisted space. There's something called the double vibration, which relates, which gives you a non-local correspondence between points in space-time and lines, these copies of CP1 in twisted space. So it basically goes as follows. Every point X in R4 can be related to a copy of CP1 whose equation as an equation of a line is given by this incidence relations, the so-called incidence relations. So I'm going to represent any such copy of CP1 associated with the point little x as capital X. So capital X will be a copy of CP1 in twisted space or a copy of the Riemann sphere. Okay. And this is just the equation of a complex projective line when you take any quotient by overall scalings of the twist. And this gives you, Laura.
No, I just had a question because here you're describing this twisted space as a vibration over the sphere. But when we are talking about compactification, when you compactify the other picture, you think of the sphere vibrated, space-time being the base, right? The compactification picture is that you always integrate over the fiber.
So the compactification.
Are these two different picture? Or which one are you?
No, this is the picture that we will use, that we should keep in our head. It's then, just that this is the picture of twisted space as a complex manifold.
Yeah.
At the level of the action and the compactification, you only need to view it as a smooth manifold because the integrals are just recognizing smooth objects. So there, you just think of it as just trivially R4 times V1 as a trivial bundle. It's a trivial smooth bundle, but it's a non-trivial complex bundle, holomorphic bundle.
But I guess when you're going to put geometry, I'm just saying usually compactification, it's the language of compactification assumes that you're integrating over the fiber. You don't integrate over the base. So that's kind of geometrically, it's kind of, because usually you quotient by the action of the fiber, and that's what you anyway.
I know. I see the intuition behind what you're saying. It's just that it so happens in this case the action only sees the smooth structure, so it's fairly easy to compactify along the P1. It doesn't see the compactification doesn't see the complex structure. The complex structure washes away in the compactification sense. Okay, am I done with the slide? Yeah. So these are the incidence relations. Every point corresponds to a curve, a twisted line in twisted space. I'm going to call them lines, even though they're actually Riemann spheres. They're complex projective lines. So let me just give you a summary of the correspondence that is going to run the twister action for gravity. I showed you the construction of twisted space for R4. What I'm going to do is deform the complex structure and turn it into an almost complex manifold. So this is going to give rise to a curved space time M, and I'm going to call the twisted space as curved twisted space. And what's in detail, points of space time X will now be in one-to-one correspondence with some deformed lines. So the lines in the original twisted space of R4 were straight lines. You can think of turning on curvature on space-time as deforming these lines into some curves in twisted space. So that's what will happen dynamically. And the metric and tetrad, the geometric data on space-time, will arise from complex structure deformation data on twisted space. So the field, the metric field on space-time, will be dual to some complex structure deformation Hamiltonian little h that I'll talk about. This will be the dynamical field, and it'll be the analog of the little a positive helicity gluon in the case theory case. So h will represent our positive helicity graviton. And the negative helicity graviton will be represented by an auxiliary field capital B, which will be the analog of the little b field. It'll impose some sort of integrability condition in the self-dual sector. And as you go away from the self-dual sector, it'll build the MHV amplitudes for you. And this will correspond to the anti-self-dual perturbations that you might be familiar from if you've read about Blavatsky type actions. I'm not going to discuss that in too much detail. I'll just show you the action in the end. But just keep in mind that one of these fields is going to be the positive helicity graviton. The other field is going to be negative helicity graviton on space-time. On twisted space, H will have a geometric interpretation, while B will have just a field theoretic Lagrange multiplier type interpretation. Okay, so how do you deform the complex structure of twisted space? So it's easiest to work in homogeneous coordinates. So capital Z are homogeneous coordinates on twisted space, where, so these are four component objects with two components that I call mu, upper alpha dot, and two components, lambda. And here I'm working in non-projective twisted space, capital T, but I've moved the projective P from front, which is just a copy of C4 minus a copy of C2, where you set lambda alpha equals here. You could just forget about this minus C2 for the rest of the talk. Basis of complex one forms that generate that define the complex structure on twisted space are dz and dz bar. These are the basis of the one not and not one forms. To deform the complex structure, what do? You take, say, you take the holomorphic cotangent bundle. So you take the basis dz, and you turn on a perturbation to them. So you basically take dz and say that you deform them into something else that you call the basis of a deformed one knot, cotangent bundle. So basically, this is just dz going to theta a equals dz minus v, where v is the so-called Beltrami differential. I'm actually not very sure about this terminology. People call such deformations Beltrami differentials in two dimensions, but I'm just calling them Beltrami differentials in this three-dimensional context, this six-dimensional context as well. This deformation looks like an anti-holomorphic one form. So if you deformed it along the holomorphic directions, it would just be in the span of dz again. So it really won't change the span of dz's. So you have to deform it in an anti-holomorphic direction to get a non-trivial deformation. But otherwise, V is a completely arbitrary field. It's going to be a field in our twister action. It's an arbitrary function of, it's an arbitrary one form on twister space. Now, when is such a deformation going to define a new complex structure? Such a deformation is said to define an almost complex structure, but it defines a complex structure when you can actually rewrite these thetas, my deformed one forms, again as coordinate one forms. So if you can define a coordinate capital W for which dz minus v is dw, then it's called a complex structure. And the condition for this to happen, the condition that the almost complex structure defined by this perturbation be a complex structure, is that the Neuenhaus tensor associated to this deformation vanish. Now, expressed in terms of these Beltrami differentials, the Neuenhaus tensor is sort of proportional to this quantity n, which looks very much like a curvature. If you remember the curvature in Young-Mills, capital V looks like a gauge field. D bar takes the place of an exterior derivative. And this looks like a second order correction to the curvature. And you can actually write this as the curvature of a Cauchy-Riemann operator, if you like, which looks like D bar plus V, but that won't be important for us. And Newland and Arenberg, Goddard, Spencer, all these people showed that if and only if this Neuhaus tensor vanish, the deformation of the complex structure is an integrable deformation. Integrable in the sense that it gives you a new complex structure. Now, we're going to deal with Hamiltonian deformations. If you just worked with capital V as a field in your action, you'd get an action for conformal gravity, which is not what we want. We want the action for conformal gravity was written down by my supervisor in 2005. But since then, they haven't been able to find an action for pure Einstein gravity. That's what we want, and that's what we're going to do. To get the action for Einstein gravity, we're going to reduce the degrees of freedom in capital V by saying that capital V comes from a potential, which is this little h, one form. So little h is a not one form on the background twister space. And you say that it comes from a potential in this sense. So capital V will be some symplectic form on twister space times dbh, where db is the twistorial derivative. The symplectic one form has occurred previously in twister literature. It's called the infinity twister, and it tells you which CP1 you remove, or which, it sort of roughly tells you the boundaries of twister space that you remove. Oh, sorry, the lines in twister space that correspond to the boundaries of space-time that you remove. So for example, when lambda is a cosmological constant, when lambda is zero, IAB tells you the equation of a line corresponding to the point I naught, the spatial infinity of Lorentzian Minkowski space. But we can formally use this in Euclidean signature as well. And the standard is to build the potential, build the Beltrami differential from a potential using the symplectic form. And now we're going to stay in the lambda equals zero case because we need to. Because this is the case I managed to work out. In the lambda equals zero case, what you do is you take the Beltrami differential. When you set lambda to zero, IAB becomes a degenerate 4x4 matrix, but it's still a non-degenerate 2x2 matrix. It's just this upper block. So what happens is half your Beltrami differential is just zero. This is a choice at this stage. I don't understand. I don't have a deeper intuition for why this is the thing that works. But if you kill half the degrees of freedom by hand, and the other half you represent in terms of this potential, then the Beltrami differential takes the simpler form. The first two components are partial h by partial mu. Theta, the deformed one naught forms, look like this. So they're just d mu alpha dot minus v, and there is no deformation along d lambda. So that's what I mean when I say that these two components are zero. D lambda is still a one naught form in the deformed almost complex structure, while d mu minus v is your actual deformed complex structure. So you only deform the complex structure along those R4 fibers, and you don't deform the almost complex structure along the base CP1 on which those R4 fibers were hanging. The Neuhaus tensor can be expressed purely in terms of little h. Again, the second two components of the Neuhaus tensor vanish, whereas the first two components give you some derivative of mu acting on this beautiful little curvature type object, d bar h plus half dh wedge dh, which only involves, so these involve mu derivatives, and d bar is just the anti-holomorphic exterior derivative in capital Z bar. So we are going to deal with such Hamiltonian deformations. Now, I see that I've already run out of time. I'll probably get fast. So the deformed incidence relations. Yeah. So what we're going to
do you can definitely take another 10 minutes or so because there were a lot of questions.
Okay, I'll take 10 minutes.
Yeah, don't rush.
So deforming the almost complex structure of twister space also deforms the almost complex structure, the complex structure on these twister lines. So we need to find a new way to define the twister lines that is consistent with the deformation of complex structure. So what I'm going to do is, the way this is done is you take mu alpha dot equals x dot lambda, and you deform it into slightly different incidence relations, which I denote by capital F. So capital F will look like x dot lambda plus some perturbation that depend on the deformation capital V. But I'm still going to call them capital X. So the line associated, now it will be a curve rather than a line. So the curve associated with little x will be capital X. The intuition as to how you define these curves is as follows. These are called rational curves, or pseudo-holomorphic rational curves of degree one. So these curves will have the property, the natural sort of extension of the properties of this thing. So I'm going to demand that it be a degree one curve in lambda. Lambda is, as I said, a parameter on CP1. So you can think of it as a parameter along the curve. Degree one just means that it is homogeneous of weight one in lambda, like this. And the other, the real property that sort of frames these curves on the deformed twisted space is that the anti-holomorphic vector fields along the curve, again, I've stated it here in terms of one forms, but a more sort of geometric intuition can be, you can build a geometric intuition in terms of not one vector fields along the curve should also be not one vector fields in the deformed almost complex structure. Where not one vector fields are defined as the kernel of the one not forms that I defined earlier. But you can find a concrete PDE for these curves in terms of the deformed one not forms by demanding that that if you take the one not the deformed holomorphic or tangent bundle, and you restrict it to these at some point here, and you restrict it to the curve, then it should turn into the standard tangent bundle on a Riemann sphere, which just has dz, d little z. If little z is a coordinate on the Riemann sphere, then if you take theta and restrict it to one of these curves, it should just turn into a d little z, like one form in the standard complex structure on the Riemann sphere. Any questions about this construction? The intuition. Again, you don't need to know all the PDEs and the details.
Maybe I'm not sure that that was a bit fast. You're saying you want to restrict.
Yeah.
So you have this holomorphic vector field on twisted space, and then you demand somehow that after some projection, or what's the equivalence?
Exactly. So. Basically, it can be sort of concretely said in terms of the one forms that if you take a one not form at any point of this curve, mm-hmm. and you restrict it to the curve, then it should turn into a one not form in this on the Riemann sphere in the standard coordinates on the Riemann sphere.
Okay.
But again, it's just it gives rise to a very simple PDE that I haven't written down for because I didn't want to confuse people. That tells you how to draw these curves in twisted space. And they just get slightly curved. They're not, they are very good and easy ways to solve that PDE. Not easy, but good ways to solve that PDE. And if you read this book by Magdiff and Salomon, they show that PDE always has solutions in a small neighborhood where the deformation is small enough. And we are going to deal with perturbative gravity anyway. Now, what this gives you is a double vibration picture again, where M is your space-time manifold X. It corresponds to a deformed curve. It corresponds to deformed incidence relations mu equals F. And this gives you a the thing that you need to remember is that it gives you a diffeomorphism, or at least a local diffeomorphism on this coordinate patch on the spacetime M. Oh yeah, sorry. I should also say that you construct the spacetime M as a modulized space of these deformed curves. But believe me, you can construct capital M and the points of capital M. Once you've constructed capital M, you get a diffeomorphism between capital M times P1 and PT. The the diffeomorphism is just given by the change of coordinates from x lambda to mu lambda, which you can actually invert. So it is this diffeomorphism that is going to run the compactification, because I'm going to write an action on PT then I'm going to pull back by this diffeomorphism to turn it into an action at m times p1, and then compactify along p1. This is not going to be a holomorphic map. So that's what I was saying earlier. It's only, the action is only going to know about the diffeomorphism, the smooth structure. Yeah.
Just a question about that diffeomorphism. Is that diffeomorphism kind of kinematical, fixed for all, or is it a dynamical field? It's going to become a dynamical field in your action.
The diffeomorphism is not a separate dynamical field. It only depends on the deformation capital V. So just to sort of recap the story, you deform the complex structure of piston space. Mm-hmm. That curves these lines into curves. And then the moduli space of that curves gives you the manifold M. And then the map for the projection from X lambda to capital F of X lambda comma lambda gives you a diffeomorphism, which is a slight deformation of this diffeomorphism.
Okay, so P is a function of V, like it's like an exponentiation.
Yes.
In some way.
Exactly. It, you can think of it as a Poisson diffeomorphism generated by that little Hamiltonian H.
By the Hamiltonian vector field. That's
exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So now let me just take two more slides and end on describing to you the twister action. The twister action is it has proven rather elusive because we didn't manage to find it for the last 15 years. The original twister action that was the closest that people came was conformal gravity, where Lionel found a twister action for conformal gravity that was fully covariant. And then for 15, now 16 years, nobody managed to find a twister action that is fully covariant for general relativity. Even now, I haven't managed to find a covariant twister action. I have managed to find an action that is background dependent. So I have chosen a concrete flat twister space as my background and then deformed around that. But if you allow yourself to work with the mentality that you want to just compute scattering processes and perturbative processes, then you quickly land on a fairly nice action that reduces to perturbative GR on spacetime. And I'm afraid it's not a theory of quantum gravity, so I would have to disappoint you in that regard. But otherwise, it's promising to be a fairly useful theory for perturbative calculations in GR. So there are two components to this action. The first component is an action for self-dual gravity. And the second component is the sort of piece that builds the MHV amplitudes for you, the perturbation away from self-duality into the anti-self-dual directions. Sorry, I didn't really define self-duality. If anyone wants to ask me about that, feel free to. But in short, it's just self-dual means positive helicity and anti-self-dual means negative helicity.
Yeah, I don't know if you say that, but implicitly in your action, you're saying that somehow integrability of this complex structure is self-dual gravity. And then putting the other graviton, you have to break that symmetry. And that's the challenge, right?
Exactly. So if you didn't have the second term, so kappa here is the gravitational coupling. When you turn that off, you get self-dual gravity because the action here is B veg N, where B is just a Lagrange multiplier field. It's a one knot form again. And the way it's written, B acts as a Lagrange multiplier when kappa is zero. You integrate it out, you get the equation of motion that N alpha dot is zero. And you get it off shell because it's a Lagrange multiplier. So that sort of imposes integrability of the complex structure deformation. And then by Penrose's nonlinear graviton theorem, it gives rise to a self-dual vacuum, a self-dual Ricci flat space-time. What I've basically done is first turned everything off shell and then written an action. And the equations of motion of this action will then give rise to twister spaces for non-self-dual Ricci flat spacetimes. And the action, of course, works for off-shell spacetimes. At least perturbatively, it will give rise to solutions. Okay. So the various objects in this action are as follows. Capital omega is a capital omega is a 3-0 pseudo-holomorphic volume form. Pseudo-holomorphic in the sense that it's a 3-0 form in the deformed almost complex structure. It's just built out of the standard volume form, holomorphic volume form on the Riemann sphere, lambda d lambda, which with the two deformed one-knot forms in the fiber directions, in the R4 directions. So theta wedge theta. B is a Lagrange multiplier, which turns into a slightly more complicated field when you turn on the ASD interactions. But roughly speaking, B corresponds to anti-self dual perturbations away from the self dual sector. H is an SL2C valued spin frame that sort of, it'll show up on the next slide. But the point is that it sort of rotates these alpha dot indices and turns it, when you do the diffeomorphism little p from p curly t to m times p1, it trivializes the bundle of dotted spinners over these curves. And that trivialization is given by this SL2C valued spin frame. But the detailed PDEs that the spin frame satisfies are given in the paper. And the point, and in this action, in the second term is defined, one of the features of the second term is that it can only be defined on, it can only be cleanly defined on M times P1. It's a non-local interaction term. That's the most important feature. It's not a local interaction because you can't build local theories on twister space that give rise to these anti-self-dual interactions. But as I will just mention on the next slide, this gives rise to a local interaction term in gravity on space-time. It's local along M. That's why it'll turn into a local thing when I compact it along P1. But it's non-local along P1 direction. So it depends on two copies of P1. The first term, on the other hand, is local. So if you like, you can use the diffeomorphism to express X and lambda in terms of capital Z. So you could think of this as an action on twister space as well, but it's just convenient to write it as an action on M times P1 directly, because otherwise I would have to pull it back by hand. So here I have two copies of the spin frame, two copies of B wedge omega, where B1 and B2 are just this Lagrange multiplier field evaluated at the coordinates of the two CP1s, like this. Bi is B of Ci, where Zi is F evaluated X comma lambda I, and lambda I are the coordinates of the two copies of the CP1s. So in short, you have a local interaction term that gives you subdual GR and a non-local interaction term that gives you anti-subdual perturbations. Okay, now how do you see equivalence with GR?
Can you just, just a question, can you comment a little bit on the form index? Like you have two Bs are holomorphic, anti-holomorphic one forms. And so you have
Bs are holomorphic.
And then you integrate over eight dimensions. Is that eight dimensions? Yeah.
Yeah, that's eight dimensional. So omega and omega are six. This is a three form, this is a one form. So that's a four form and that's a four form. Mm-hmm. Thanks. Okay. Now, how do you see? Can you see this live? Please remove this. Better. Okay. How do you see equivalence with GR on space time? So this is carried through by using Penrose transforms and a secret application of Liouville's theorem, which I won't go into to keep the talk short. Firstly, the second term is already ready for compactification as it is. It's on M times P1 squared. The first term can be turned into an action on M times P1 by using the diffeomorphism. But this is what you call, say, pulling back by the incidence relations. So you would have an action in terms of capital Z, but you write capital Z as F comma lambda. So you pull back by the incidence relations to get an action that's local on M times P1. The beauty of this action is that it has an enhanced gauge symmetry that's generated by a secret constraint that's hidden in the first term. So if you take the field P star B is a one form on M times P1. So you can decompose it into a one form along P1 and a one form along the M directions. Basically, this is in the span of the P1 one forms dz, d little z, d little z bar, if you like. And this is in the span of dx alpha. If you do this decomposition, then you see that the second term actually drops out of this interaction term. That happens because P1 star omega 1 by P2 star omega 2, you can prove that this thing is already proportional to D4X or the volume form on M. So any one form in the second term along M wedged against the top form along M has to drop out. That's why P star B drops out of the second term. And it only occurs as a Lagrange multiplier in the first term. Since it occurs as a Lagrange multiplier, it imposes the off-shell constraint. It imposes an off-shell constraint, which you can sort of stare hard at the first term in the action and show that it's a constraint that a particular component of P star N alpha dot that is orthogonal to P star B vanishes. So P star B is a one form along M. So the orthogonal one forms are the one forms along the Riemann sphere. And this just says that there is no anti-holomorphic component of the Neuhaus tensor along the Riemann sphere. D by D lambda, so lambda was a coordinate. D by D lambda bar is an anti-holomorphic vector field along the Riemann sphere in the coordinates lambda. And this is just telling us that the Neuhaus tensor, the curvature, the Neuhaus tensor vanishes along the curves, roughly speaking. It's only non-trivial along the fiber directions. This constraint is so powerful that it essentially generates an extra gauge symmetry, but the way I'm going to think about it is, it's so powerful, it's an off-shell constraint, it can actually be exactly solved, and it trivializes the lambda dependence of all these fields. And all the fields turn into some simple function that's only a function of x, the space-time coordinate, times some very simple lambda dependence. This constraint can be solved exactly, and the solution, well, solved in the sense solved for the fields. So you could solve it for the field capital B, but it's easier to solve it for the deformed one knot form theta. You solve it for P star theta, and that looks like, the solution looks like lambda times a spin frame and a cell to C valued spin frame, which can also be determined. Its lambda dependence can be determined using a PDE, times four one forms on space time. And these four one forms on space time, yeah, they're really four one forms on space time. So now you have sort of fixed the lambda dependence. You've killed the KK modes. It is this constraint that sort of kills the KK modes and only makes the only things that remain are sort of the integration constants when you solve this PDE, roughly speaking. And these integration constants are constant along the Riemann sphere. The next thing is, with this, you can also define an extra anti-self-dual field as a Penrose transform B. And this is just a definition, but the magic happens when you use this solution and this definition into this action. When you do that, you can, the P1 sort of dependence is completely fixed. You can do the integrals along P1. That's what I mean by the compactification. It's just a classical compactification of the off-shell action. And when you do the integrals over P, when it gives rise, in terms of these fields E and gamma, to the Plobansky action for gravity. This action, roughly speaking, is saying that this is the anti-self-dual curvature, and gamma is the anti-self-dual part of the spin connection of the curvature, and E actually acts as a tetrad for a metric on space-time. So I'm hoping people might be familiar with this action. The interesting thing is that this action is sort of expanded around the, yeah. Laura?
Yeah, no, just it's a comment. I mean, I think people are familiar with this action, but the name you associate with it is really weird. I think, you know—
Sorry.
This action much before, and I don't think Euler was the first one. I mean, he can—
I'll tell you the story. So what happened with Plobansky studied a slightly different action. It was a fully covariant action. What the trick that Abu Zaid and Hull did, so in Plobansky's action, kappa squared doesn't sit here. It sits in front as 1/kappa squared. The trick that Abu Zaid and Hull did was sort of rescale gamma. It's a very, very basic thing, but I have to cite them because they did it in their paper and nobody tried to do this before. So they did this, and they rescale gamma, and then kappa squared shows up here. It's the same thing that you do in QED, for example, where you take a mu and rescale the a mu by the coupling constant, so that sits in front of the
except that gamma is a connection, and you cannot rescale connection because it's an affine space. So
well, you can if you choose a background for the connection.
That's
what I said. You have to be in the mentality of a scattering amplitude.
Yeah, as a covariant action, it's not possible.
Exactly. So this is no longer covariant, and that's what makes my supervisor very sad. But I'm very happy because I can do actual computations for that. And
there is a covariant action like that. I mean, Lee can comment, but Jacobson, I mean, there's this in the 90s, people wrote this covariant action in that way. Lee should.
Oh, no, I meant there is no covariant twister action yet.
Okay,
the analog of this. Yeah, the twister action I have gives rise to this non-covariant action space.
Okay.
Yeah. Does someone say something? Okay. So this is it. I'll not talk about the applications, but I'm happy to share the slides if that's what you guys do. And let me go to my conclusions. So you can derive the scattering amplitude for MHV gravitons using this very concretely. There are some more interesting twister sigma models here that you could look at in my slides. So what is this good for? Just like Young-Mills, the main hope is that this action will be useful for generating an MHV formalism for gravity, whereby we would be able to compute scattering amplitudes in just pure gravity without any supersymmetry at loop level very efficiently. BCFW doesn't do that. BCFW works at tree level, but since BCFW is an on-shell recursion relation, but it doesn't have an off-shell formulation like MHV rules that I described, it doesn't do anything. It doesn't give you the correct answer at loop level for pure gravity. But here I have an action which should, if you study its perturbation theory carefully enough, give rise to an MHV formalism that could be used potentially at loop level as well. There might be anomalies and stuff like that one has to think about, but if all of those work out, then there might be a formalism that you could use at loop level to compute graviton amplitudes very efficiently in pure gravity without any supersymmetry. We don't like supersymmetry in the real world, so we need that. So that's exciting. So extending gravitational twister string technology, twister actions, effective actions of twister strings. So there's some hope. These two points are basically the same point. And then there's some hope that we might be able to covariantize this action, because once you have a covariant action, you would expand around different backgrounds, such as in flat backgrounds, and then compute amplitudes around curved backgrounds, like maybe even ADS or cosmology or some other backgrounds. And then there's the possibility that you could study SD gravity by using Chern-Simons type actions, which is ongoing work with Skinner and Biddleston, which actually motivated the whole thing. Apparently there was no BF action, so why study the Chern-Simons action, which is much more complicated. So the BF action works, and our hope is that in a few months, the Chern-Simons action will also work, and we'll have more familiar subdual gravity models. And the hope is that we will be able to study the quantum integrability of these models on twister space. Okay, that's it. Thanks for listening. And sorry for being highly over time. Feel free to ask any questions you like.
Yeah, thank you, Arturo, for this very nice talk. Are there any more questions? And as usual, first by students. Yes, Roland.
Of course.
Please go ahead.
Hi. The Young-Mills, that twister action for Young-Mills, you can view as a truncation of the twist action for n equals 4 super Young-Mills, which is, of course, a Chern-Simons theory with a log debt term. So can you view this as a truncation of like Poisson Chern-Simons theory on n equals 8 super twister space with some like log debt term? Do you have any idea what that might be?
Well, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say this, but Lionel had a secret notes file in which he had a very secret conjecture for that, but that didn't work. So no, I at the moment, I don't even have a conjecture for the log debt term, because I do not even, I believe the log dead term is the effective in the gauge theory case, the log dead term is the effective action of the instantons. And I guess, so I don't know how to get that, but I believe Witten has a way to get the effective action of the instantons as the target space action. And I don't know how all that technology is understood in Dave's twisted string. Dave's twisted string is not a very standard-ish topological B model, I believe. It's first order formalism, which I don't even know how to turn it into a second order formalism to get an action. So no, I don't think I have a very good answer to your question right now. Nima asked the same question, and Lionel probably is thinking about this. Yeah.
Super, thank you.
Thanks for the question, Ron.
Any more questions by students?
Hello, may I ask a question?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay, here you mentioned loop level graviton scattering. Do you mean loop integrand or loop amplitude? Integrand or loop, integral?
I will mean the loop integrand, yes. In all this amplitude business, usually these rules compute loop integrands for you. And then the integrals come out as moduli space integrals in the twister action sense, and space-time integrals in the space-time perturbation theory sense.
Okay, another question is that why this FW field at one loop graviton scattering? I mean, maybe the loop propagator is massive and it's off-shell. We can use higher dimension to treat the massive loop momentum as a massless momentum. So I think this FW should still work there.
I'm sorry, what do you mean?
Why you mentioned this FW doesn't work at one loop?
BCFW. Yeah, yes. The problem with BCFW is that it's not, it doesn't have an interpretation or a derivation from an off-shell principle like an action. So it's not the Feynman rules of a quantum field theory. So we know that it works for any, I believe it works for any equal state supergravity, but it doesn't work at loop level for pure gravity. Or I don't think we have a BCFW formalism. I think there is something in the gauge theory case where they can at least get leading singularities at loop level. But for gravity, this hasn't been explored very much.
Yeah.
From what I understand. Yeah.
Okay, so I accept that. There are little results about one loop graviton using BCFW. But here, at least you mentioned non-supersymmetric. So you mean this FW works for supersymmetric gravity at one loop level?
So I've never actually used that myself, but I've heard that it works, yeah. I believe it does. But Don't quote me on that, might be wrong. At tree level, it works, and N equals 8. The point is that for maximally supersymmetric theories, some of the diagrams are absent. Only the nicest diagrams remain. And for when you decrease supersymmetry, extra diagrams get generated. So,
I think if there are tadpole and the massless bubble and it's a problem for BCFW, then I think it should still be a problem for twister string formula.
It is going to be a problem for twister string, but in the twister action case, it's going to just give you a good old quantum field theory, and which you can study the loop level perturbation theory of, which is equivalent to space-time perturbation theory. So it just has to work modulo some secret anomalies that show up due to some topological term corrections, which I don't think will show up. It just has to work because the MHV rules that will show up will just be the Feynman rules of an action that is equivalent to the action of gravity on space-time.
Okay, that's your point. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's just Feynman diagrams in a fancy twistorial way. by still finding diagrams.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the questions.
Okay, are there any more questions by students or anyone else?
Can I ask a quick question? Thanks for the talk. I arrived late, so maybe you said it already, but so this is a new action for gravity using twisters instead of the usual variables, right? And yeah. How do simple solutions like black holes and so on look like in this language?
So I haven't really explored that yet because this is very recent work, but you could sort of, but I could tell you what they look like in the Yang-Mills case, as some students have explored that. So in that case, what you do is you take the black hole solution and you sort of take its sort of self-dual part, and you can find, by now in textbooks actually, you can find its self-dual, the twister field, a little a, that corresponds to the self-dual part. And then you put it in the equations of motion, you try to solve for little b as a perturbation away from little a. So the problem with all of this twistorial stuff in generating classical solutions is that it can only generate classical solutions perturbatively around some expansion around G Newton or kappa, or in the Yang-Mills case, in the Yang-Mills coupling.
So okay, maybe that's my question. Why is that true? Why can you only generate perturbations around some simple background?
That's because it can only generate, these sort of actions are pivoted around the self-dual sector. So you can generate the non-linear self-dual solutions fully non-linearly, but little b is from the very start, its life is as a perturbative gluon, as an ASD perturbation around the self-dual sector. So it's just the nature of the equations of motion of these actions.
Your action as well? Your action connections. Also think, is your action like that as well?
So the action is the equations of motion, the equations of motion will look like some self-dual condition plus some perturbative correction in terms of the b's. And then you can sort of, that perturbative correction will have a kappa squared in front of it. So you just solve that equation perturbatively, like a phi cubed equation or something like that. Let me restart the slideshow.
It's related to the problem. You don't have a non-perturbative formulation, right?
So it's not possible to write Schwarzschild in this twister variables.
Well, they don't have yet a covariant formulation. It's only perturbative.
Yeah. The sort of point is that we're not trying to apply, at the moment at least, we're not trying to apply the action with the philosophy of getting nonlinear solutions, but instead to scattering amplitudes. And you are right. From what I understand from previous work, it's not easy to write non-self-dual solutions. It is possible in a perturbative expansion, but it's not useful for that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
The hope is that we might be able to do that from an ambitwister action. So there's a sort of parity symmetric version of twister space, which is called ambitwister space, which is sort of a glued together or Cartesian, roughly a Cartesian product of twister and something called a dual twister space, which is another copy of P3. And you can, for Yang-Mills, there's a way to build a parity symmetric ambitwister space action on that bigger ambitwister space, which is again equivalent to Yang-Mills on space-time by some Penrose transform and compactification technology. And nobody has done this yet, but it might be possible there to get fully nonlinear solutions, because that is parity symmetric. It doesn't favor the self-dual or the anti-self-dual part. But it's not very useful when you want to do scattering. So we don't use that very much.
Sorry, I didn't know that ambitwister action for Yang-Mills. What does it look like? Is it like a two Chern-Simons theories coupled or something? I don't know.
It's just a Chern-Simons theory with a pole in Z dot W. So it's a Chern-Simons theory divided by Z dot W to the fourth. Z is a twister variable and W is a dual twister variable.
Oh.
It's an action written by Mason and Skinner.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I should probably know that one.
You should know that.
I'll see that. Okay, I'll put it out. Okay, cool. Thanks. That's really interesting.
Thanks for the question.
Laurent.
Well, I ask many questions, so if there's other people first, they should go.
Yeah, maybe I can ask a very quick question. So it seems that all your formalism kind of builds onto GR. Have you thought about or looked into what a generalization would look like? So I give you some gravitation action with maybe, I don't know, an R squared term. Is it clear how to generalize that formalism to that different gravitational action?
Well, firstly, nobody has worked that out, but the way to do that will possibly be to first write a Blavatsky type action for these perturbations. Now, the nice thing about GR is that there's a very natural Blavatsky action. And I do not know if there's a similar chiral action for these higher R squared terms and things like that. But if you could do that, then the other nice thing about GR is that it's the simplest thing. It's highly geometric. And the correspondence that I showed you that allows the compactification is very specific to GR, right? Yes. To the Ricci flat vacuum solutions. In fact, at the moment, I haven't even tried to couple matter to it, though I do assume that that will be simple enough because you can couple matter to the Yang-Mills case. But I do not know how to do R squared or things like that at the moment.
Okay.
Do you actually, sorry, I'm now curious, do you know of any chiral formulations of R squared, things like that?
Sure. Sure, we've got lots of chiral formulations of R squared.
I see. So there is one. Okay.
Well, look, for example, in a paper with Stefan Alexander and Jean Maguejo and a couple of other people about 2 years ago.
So your paper, right?
And these other people.
Okay. Thank you. I'll look for that. That's very interesting.
Okay. Any other questions by people before Long starts his series of questions?
Not the series. Just a
question. Okay, go ahead, Laurent.
I want to go back to this question of what is it good for? Because you mentioned celestial holography, so are you hinting that somehow these, you know, and in celestial holography, what's really good about it is that you have this infinite dimensional symmetry group that organizes all our understanding of the amplitude. So are you kind of implying that by using this twister action, maybe this infinite dimensional symmetry is more manifest, or it's completely different?
No, that's right. So the first thing is that because Kevin and Natalie Paquette already have results on this, and in their results, they show that if you take the self-dual part, so one of the things that I didn't mention is that the self-dual part, the B-wedge and this first term was known by Lionel. It was there in a paper by Lionel and David, and then in a paper by Mason, Lionel and Martin Wolf. If you study this self-dual part, then you can actually apply some sort of twisted holography to it. Okay, I think I'm going to summarize what Kevin told me earlier in a different talk. So if you take twister space, you have this action on twister space. Now, in celestial holography, you're familiar with this hyperbolic foliation of space-time, where you take space-time and you foliate it with slices that are quotients by dilatations. So you like the Sitter slices and ADS slices inside the light cone. In Euclidean signature, the analogous foliation is by S copies of S3. So if you take your twister action, you do a very clever thing to it. You could either compactify along CP1 and get an action on space-time that you marvel at and you say that it's subdual gravity on space-time, Lebesgue events. But what happens if you take the twister action and you compactify along the S3 slices of R4 in R4 times V1. If you do that, then you actually get a theory on R times P1, roughly speaking. So R4 is S3 times R. R4 minus the origin is S3 times R. If you compactify the twister action along the R4, along the S3 slices, then you get an action on R times P1 on twister space. That, what Costello did is sort of broke that R copy of the real numbers in half. So you actually, he actually produced a boundary. And the boundary, the manifold that you have your action now is R positive, half the real line, times P1. Now this boundary is a copy of P1. And the bulk is R times P, R positive times P1. So if you study this theory on R positive times P1, you can actually apply twisted holography to this three-dimensional theory and get something on the boundary P1 that turns out to be the soft, the algebras of soft theorems, positive helicity gluons and graviton soft theorems that Strominger and Guevara and Himwich and Pate and other people have found. So there's this duality here. The twister action is a mother theory in some sense. If you go along space-time by compactifying on P1, you get a space-time theory. But if you compactify along the S3 slices that generate the dilatation quotient for you, or the hyperbolic, the Euclidean signature hyperbolic foliation for you, then you get a 3D theory whose boundary theory is this two-dimensional chiral algebra. What I would like to see is, in Kevin's results, so this isn't published yet, in Kevin's results, at least he only is he's only able to reproduce these W infinity, these soft algebras, the algebras of the soft gluon graviton. What I would like to see is whether we could use twisted holography or some deformation of twisted holography to also generate the hard celestial OPEs, or at least the positive helicity hard celestial OPEs. So that would be super interesting if that works. So my hope is that it will, but there will be some systematic deformation of twisted holography, perhaps some other version of holography that is topological enough for self-dual gravity that might produce the hard OPE as well. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, partially. But maybe a little bit in the long way. What I'm looking for is the shortcut. It's just I just want the symmetry, because all these OPEs are expressions of the symmetry. So if I can just reveal the symmetry at the level of the action, I don't need to go this long way, you see? So I was wondering whether you were hoping that this formulation allowed to reveal this symmetry right away, like instead of just doing this long-winded calculation.
So, yeah, okay, sure. What I told you was the thing that seems to have holographic flavor. Mm-hmm. But yes, what you could do to see the symmetries, actually that is manifest even in Penrose's constructions in the 1980s. So for example, this gravitational theory is built out of, so even though I haven't expressed it directly in terms of little h, it's built out of the Hamiltonian for the Beltrami, the complex structure deformation. Mm-hmm. If you study the diffeomorphism symmetries of this theory, the symmetry, the gauge symmetries of this action, then they're actually Poisson diffeomorphisms because they have to generate diffeomorphisms of the little h potential and not generic deformation, generic diffeomorphisms. These Poisson diffeomorphisms of twister space give rise to diffeomorphisms on space-time on compactification. But on twister space, these are Poisson diffeomorphisms, so they are directly related to this W infinity algebra that people observe. These Poisson diffeomorphisms have the special, in the zero cosmological constant case, these Poisson diffeomorphisms have the special property that they only diffeomorph along the R4 slices of twister space, while the coordinate lambda is preserved in the diffeomorphism map. And the R4 slices can be viewed as C2 slices, two-dimensional complex planes, and the algebra of generators of Poisson diffeomorphisms of C2 is W1 plus infinity. Mm-hmm. That Andy found. Mm-hmm. And since these diffeomorphisms don't change lambda but can still depend on lambda, so the diffeomorphisms can be different as you vary the slices. These are this generates a one parameter family of diffeomorphisms. So that's what we call loop algebra of W1 plus infinity. And this loop algebra or Katz-Moody algebra of W1 plus infinity is what you see as a symmetry, as generating the diffeomorphism symmetries of this action. It's even clearer. In fact, Lionel, Tim, Adamo, and I had a recent paper on using world sheet theories for target space, twister space. So these world sheet theories for which this kind of action could potentially be a target space effective action, these world sheet theories make it even more manifest what the symmetries of the system are. So world sheet theory that I'm talking about is here. There's a world sheet theory that generates that formula for the MHB graviton amplitude. It's this world sheet theory. And this basically contains a field little m, which is a perturbation of the incidence relations geometrically. And the point is that this directly, you can write down symmetry generators of these Poisson diffeomorphisms in terms of operators in this world sheet theory. And you can directly show that this theory computes. Firstly, you can show that this correlation functions in this theory compute gravitational scattering amplitudes. Yeah. And then you can compute the action of these symmetry charges on these amplitudes and get the celestial OPE that Andy found.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so just to summarize, to see if I understood properly, you're telling me that you can show explicitly that your action is invariant under this, looping.
Everything happened.
Is it written now or yet, or it's going to, like how the action transform, is this precisely written yet?
Or? So the thing that's written down is the, so the twister action is sort of implicitly invariant under Poisson diffeomorphism by construction, but that's not the most that's not the nicest way to make these W infinity symmetries manifest. Yeah. The nice way is through these world sheet models, and that's written in. I haven't cited it in this talk, but it is another citation which reads the same. Basically, it's my. Well, I had a paper today, so it's the last paper of mine with Lionel and Tim, which makes all of this clear, manifest that how you get symmetries in twister space and how they sort of turn into symmetries of the celestial OPE, at least in the positive LSP sector.
Okay. So, yeah, you get only half of the, I mean, you only get the, okay, the W.
At the moment, the clearest thing is for the positive LSP sector. We can also get the negative LSP sector using something called ampli-twister spring. So that was in a paper today that we put out.
So is it clear?
But it's not geometrically clear. Yeah, we can derive it, but it doesn't have a Poisson diffeomorphism interpretation at the moment.
And is it clear that it's, I don't know, that it can be non-anomalous or that there's anomalies, or you haven't talked yet about that? Once you have this.
No, we haven't studied the loop level effects yet. That would be a very interesting thing to do, try to study any central extensions and things like that. There are some loop level, there are some interesting things to do at loop level in these models themselves, which might have some consequence for quantum integrability of SDGR. But again, I digress. Okay, thanks. Thanks for the questions. Any other questions? Sorry.
Sorry, Anton. Do you know what the target space description of the sigma model is? I mean, it looks like it depends on two choices of spinners. So are you expecting this to be like Planck-Lubanski action?
Roland, I don't know the
target. Okay. I wasn't sure because you put out these papers and I haven't read them. So I don't know if you were.
Good. No. We should do this. Yeah, absolutely.
We should. Well, we should meet anyway.
No. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe David has better things. Maybe David has better conjectures. That world sheet models might be. Yeah.
Teaching something. Anyway, sorry. Good. Okay. I was just interested.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Are there any last minute questions? people are already leaving. So good, seems not to be the case. Thanks again, Atul, for this very nice talk.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Good to see you.
Good, and see you all next week.
Am I allowed to join other talks in your seminars if I find something interesting?
Yes, certainly. I think the links should be on the PI website, so you can just join. Or if you don't manage, there's the library of talks where you can just see all past talks.
Thank you. And thanks again.
Yeah. Anytime.
Okay.